Hello and welcome to the Frontier Strategy Group podcast series. FSG is the leading information services partner for emerging markets executives. We partner with business leaders at over 200 multinationals by providing them with research analytical tools and data that help power their emerging markets business strategies. My name is Richard Leggett and I'm the CEO of FSG. Today's podcast is part of our Emerging Market Executive Spotlight series. I'm honored to be joined today by Dr. Jaime Marquez, a senior adjunct professor in international economics at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And until his recent retirement, he served as a senior international economist at the United States Federal Reserve Board, where he had worked for 30 years. Jaime is a true expert in international monetary economics, international trade, and econometrics, and I'm delighted to say he's a close advisor to Frontier Strategy Group. Our discussion today will be broad-ranging, focused on Jaime's views on best practices for modeling the international economy, applying econometrics to business forecasting, and Jaime's views on the economic outlook for 2014. As a reminder, this podcast and all of FSG's content is available via our portal at portal.frontierstrategygroup.com. Jaime, welcome and thanks for joining today.
Thank you so much. This is a real pleasure, and I am delighted to be of assistance with your questions and my views.
I'm super excited about our conversation today, and I want to get started. But before we do that, if we could spend a minute or two on your background. One of the great benefits of my job is that I get to spend significant time with our client executives and our advisors, and I always find their personal journeys fascinating. And yours is really interesting, from a childhood in Venezuela to one of the most senior economic advisors to the Fed. Could you maybe just walk us through your journey?
Delighted. I was born in Venezuela in 1954, and then I contracted polio in 1955. I mentioned the polio thing because it shaped a great deal my views of the world, my views of how I interact with the rest of the world, and it effectively shaped my personality. Following that, I was trained by Jesuits from kindergarten all the way through college. And so I'm pretty good at inflicting guilt on others. And
I was as well.
Yeah, okay. So I am good at inflicting guilt. And along with the Jesuits, they moved me up and down that track. I came to the United States in 1978 and to study a PhD in economics in the University of Pennsylvania. And right on cue, the very first day of class, I really meet this beautiful, stunning woman. It was stunning. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. We started going out soon thereafter, and we got married, and we have been married for the last 32 years. So she is that beautiful. At Penn, I study econometrics and international trade. I wrote a thesis involving the determination of oil prices using an econometric model of world trade. And after graduating from Penn, I went to work for the Federal Reserve Board in the Division of International Finance. And that was my mothership for 30 years.
That's fascinating. It's the first time, I think, on a podcast we have a love story, which is great as well. let's get started maybe at the 30,000-foot level. To the extent that you're allowed to and can speak about this, during your time at the Fed, you and your colleagues were essentially tasked with modeling the world economy, which is no small task. And I thought maybe you could walk us through the methodology, the process, your model at a high level.
Well, let me start by saying that modeling at the Fed or any other institution is not a one-man show. It is the result of a modeling group, modeling team, where we all do our little share and we all exchange views. We all get frustrated with the other's work and we just move on. But with respect to how do we go about it, I think modeling at the Fed in particular involves asking or addressing two questions. The first one is, what do we want out of this model? And the second one is, can we get what we want given the data and the estimation methods? In my case, we began with the belief that international trade matters for domestic economic developments. Our exports are somebody else's imports, and our imports are somebody else's exports. So understanding trade matters for us and for them. Similarly, our capital inflows are somebody else's capital outflows and vice versa. So both knowledge about international trade and international finance was the guiding force in the design of the model. We then translated that knowledge into equations. We believe that imports depend on income and relative prices. Well, okay, how? And so you translate that knowledge into an equation. And you don't know whether this is ultimately going to be the equation that you want because you don't know the parameter values. You don't know how this equation interacts with the rest of the model. And so you have to apply the econometrics to it, put it with the rest of the model, and see if you like it. So the process is largely iterative and time-consuming. But by the time you get there, you're completely hooked on this. Very little else matters once you are into that world.
We're increasingly hearing the term econometrics used more frequently. And I guess for our listening audience, could you give us your preferred definition of econometrics and what are the different flavors or types of econometrics?
Econometrics can be best viewed as a toolkit that helps practitioners combine economic theory, which is very general, with the statistical theory. And so when you combine these two lines of inquiry, then you get something econometrics. How do I characterize the response of consumption to income? Well, in doing that, you need to figure out what you mean by consumption, what do you mean by income, and then how do I relate the two guys, and then what method for parameter estimation I'm going to use. So that is the old definition of econometrics. Since then, econometrics has moved in many directions. For example, you can have a collection of consumption data across countries along with their income. And so you can do what we call cross-section regressions, which relate consumption purchases in one country to the income in that country, and you do this for all the countries. Another type of econometrics is what we call time series. So instead of having data across countries, you have data for one country, but across time. So this enables you to model and predict consumption as time evolves. And then the guys in my tribe moved on and said, well, we can have it both ways. We can have cross-section and we can have time series. And that has become known as panel data. The latter is increasing importance in the field of econometrics.
And so if you think about that from a almost an academic perspective and then bring it down to the world that our clients live in every day, how applicable is econometrics to our client executives as they think about their business planning and their day-to-day execution?
I tend to understand lines of work by analogy. So let me give you one. I view econometrics in day-to-day work in the same way that I view a car's headlights. They are especially helpful when driving at night. Now, you don't need them during the day, but you need them at night. I don't have experience as a business person, but I suspect that quantifying uncertainty, namely darkness, and assessing the factors that determine that uncertainty are important for business. And this is exactly what I think econometrics can do, to shed some light on that uncertainty and on the factors that determine it. Econometrics is going to do this by relying on data, statistics, and economic theory. And what we get out of it is the ability to ask what-if questions repeatedly and have some confidence that the resulting answers are based on the data that we're trying to understand. To put it succinctly, we can drive at night without headlights. It is just not a good idea.
That's a good, very, very well put. In the current environment, along that spirit, in the current environment, which is for our executives very, very much characterized by getting more return from their existing investments in emerging markets, many of our clients are working with FSG to build more precise approaches for portfolio management of their resources. And specifically, we work with clients on portfolio allocation, more precise demand forecasting, and predictive analytics. So if you could put yourself into the shoes of, again, a client executive, how would you go about using a combination of macroeconomic, industry, and other indicators to basically better forecast their business, especially in the incredibly volatile emerging markets?
Well, to answer that, let me pretend for a moment, and this is really pretending, that I'm involved in the production of consumer goods and that I do this in different countries. So I have production lines in different countries that I can then sell in also different countries. And then the question that I ask myself is, what is the most profitable mix of countries to produce and sell? Answering this question involves being able to change the production intensity in response to changes in the exchange rates. That is, by monitoring exchange rates, I can increase the production rate in a country where producing is cheaper. So monitoring labor market developments across countries is important because I would not like to increase the production rate in a country with a tight labor market. And this is a long way of saying that I need to be paying a lot of attention to the policy mix across countries. This is not an easy thing to do, but it's what I will be doing. I also need to pay a lot of attention to the price of my competitors. I should expect changes in the demand for my product when my competitors change their prices. Well, what affects their willingness to change their prices? Here I will be looking at the price elasticity of the demand for my product with respect to the prices of my competitors. So I need to monitor their prices, I need to monitor the factors that go into their prices, their input mix. Estimating it, this elasticity involves looking at personal incomes, demographics, the distribution of income, and market shares for my competitors. Again, it is not an easy thing to do, but it is the sort of thing that we need to do in order to remain competitive and perhaps grow.
Jaime, just as a follow-up to that, when we think about modeling and demand forecasting for clients, how precise do you think a client organization can get with regards to modeling based on, down to product and down to countries and even within countries, certain areas within those countries?
There's nothing in econometrics that says it has to be at the country level. Nothing. Let me just give you an example. I use data from the International Comparison Projects Purchasing Power Parities, and that is at the level of coffee, the level of rice. And we have modeled that. Again, it is not an easy thing to do. There's nothing embodied in econometrics that says it has to be for the country or it has to be for aggregate consumption. There are, and I have done it, there are studies that enable you to estimate the demand for very fine products. The glitch that arises most of the time is that the demand, say, for ivory is going to be influenced by considerations that are sometimes hard to measure. Say, advertising, the advertising of your competitors. And so the finer the product, the greater is the role for idiosyncratic factors. The question is, well, what's the alternative? Do you want to just say, well, we have been growing at 2% per year, so let's assume that that's going to continue? That strikes me as driving without the headlights on.
Yeah, and I think that's the shift that we're seeing happening in emerging markets, because for a long time you could drive without the headlights in emerging markets, but that world has changed now. Yeah. Let's talk up for a second about monitoring and using your time as a Fed at the Fed as a guide. How should clients think about establishing a continual process to monitor and readjust plans to account for the unpredictable and for the volatility?
I do not see continual process to monitor as optional. I really see it as a necessity. To be frank, I would not be surprised at all if the guys at the Federal Reserve have been glued to their monitors in the econometric models to figure out the implications of the ECB's recent reductions of their interest rate. But not just big developments, but also when I was there, we used to revise the forecast in response to changes in revisions of the data, in response to data developments. And this is a never-ending process. This is not the sort of thing that you do when you get time to it. This is the sort of thing that you do all the time. Unfortunately, it's not the only thing that you do. You also have to combine this monitoring with a device. It is not enough to just watch the TV monitor and memorize the evolution of the Dow Jones for that day and say, well, now what? So what we do is we just look at the developments, data revisions that are relevant for the model, and then every time that there is a GDP revision, we go and recompute the forecast. Every time that there is a release of the international capital flows of the United States, we bring the data and re-examine the extent to which we were surprised by the data, and therefore, should we go and change the forecast? And so it is not just continuous monitoring, it's that you got to translate that monitoring to an informational piece that enables you to draw out the implications of those revisions. And that's where the econometric models come in. I don't think the econometric models have a privileged status of that. Other people have different mechanisms to extrapolate the implications of data. I have a bias in favor of econometrics because it is the one tool that enables me to relate the data to what we're trying to explain. And if the mechanism that I have is unrelated to the data or disconnected from the data, then I'm just daydreaming.
And so if you reconcile that with our clients' world, which is one where they maybe have an annual planning cycle, and then obviously things are changing so rapidly, and especially in the emerging markets, it's often a challenge for our clients. I was just with a bunch of Latin American CEOs last week, and you know, the assumptions when they set their plans last November to where they are today, and so much has changed in terms of currency movements, in terms of commodity prices, in terms of slowdown of demand. How can a company who has to report on a quarterly basis to shareholders, how do they make these adjustments in your view?
I don't think there is a neat answer to that question. So let me see if I can give you my take. A particular company is going to be subject to, say, as you noted, to exchange rate developments, to changes in regulations, to changes in the price of their competitors, to changes in the prices of their inputs. And out of this, sometimes this information do not point to a particular unambiguous direction. So the exchange rate may be turning favorable to producing more, but regulations are increasing the cost of firing an individual or raising the cost of paying for a new permit to produce a new plant. I think, from my standpoint, that I don't know how to do this without an econometric model that enables me to assemble all these conflicting pieces of evidence into a coherent whole. If the object, say, is forecasting sales, it doesn't have to be, it could be forecasting revenues or forecasting profits. Well, then I want to have a model that explains sales. I want to have a model that explains how those sales are generated. That is, what is the production line? What inputs do they use? What's the mix between labor and capital? Who determines the wages? How important are labor unions? I want all that, and it is going to take a little while to get it, but without it, I'm just driving without the headlights on.
Yeah, and so what we advocate, and tell me what you think about this, is that clients, obviously they have to build plans and have a line, a baseline assumption, but we often advocate having scenario plans as part of the part of the equation.
The way one can go about this is to assume that, well, my baseline is not going to change. That doesn't strike me as the way to go. And to the extent that the key ingredients for business decisions change and they do not always change in the same direction, then I want to be able to get a grip on the extent to which changes in those magnitudes, changes in those variables are affecting either my bottom line or the sales. For example, say that a country is subject to capital inflows, or it experienced capital inflows, but that these capital inflows are volatile, and that the volatility of these capital inflows is going to translate into volatility of the exchange rate of that country, perhaps also in the interest rate that the firm will borrow. Then I would like to know how sensitive are my sales to changes in the exchange rate. This is a long way of saying I want to know the price elasticity of my product. So a scenarios is, I think, one very important way of getting a sense of how sensitive is what we're doing to changes in the variables that we cannot control. When you look at the forecast for storms or hurricanes, then you're seeing the evening news and you see the person from the weather segment and you see where the current hurricane is, and then they show you the path. But they don't show you a one line, they show you a whole cone. Well, how did they get that cone? Well, they're doing a sensitivity analysis. So if I were to say, I'm interested in forecasting my sales, but I cannot give you a precise number for it. I can give you a sense of whether the sales are going to be growing between 3% and 10%. If we don't like that number, then we have to do something. But then it's important to confront that number from the get-go.
Yeah, that's a good point. Our clients often tell us they're overwhelmed with data and information, but at the same time, often lack quality data. And so, again, your challenge at the Fed and your experience at the Fed, I think, could be helpful here, and also with your FSG experiences to date. And so I'd be curious how you would think our clients should filter through, you know, the noise to understand what are the critical few data points that are the most significant leading indicators for business planning.
I don't see a neat solution to this dilemma. I think the abundance of information can truly be paralyzing. And the way I think about this is I sometimes, hopefully not anymore, for a while, I was told to go and buy some cereal in the supermarket without further instructions, and you show up in the aisle of the cereal, and then you say, well, and which one? And so it's just not that helpful to be involved in buying cereal, unless you know exactly what you want. Then that raises the question, well, how do I know what I want? From the firm standpoint, I think there are two options. The first one is that you deploy a research team in your company and go for the answer. So in that case, the firm will have to make decisions as to what pieces of information will be relevant for the firm's decision. Is it the case that every single movement in every single interest rate, short and long, are of the essence? Well, we're going to have to find out. So the firm can go and do their own research and then reach the answer. This reminds me of the framework that Ford Company had many years ago, in which they produced everything that they needed, literally everything. So they needed glass for the windshield. Well, we need to go and produce glass. And to produce glass, you need this input. Well, we go and produce that one too. It was complete vertical integration. That does not strike me as the way to go. It would be akin for thinking of the United States or any other country to engage in producing everything that they need, regardless of other countries having the same products at a lower cost. And so the second option in my mind is to recognize that there is a lot of expertise in data gathering, statistical processing, economic modeling, and professional services tailored to the client, and that the firm can access these services at a lower cost than they will have to pay. And moreover, they could ask for this cost, for these services to be tailored as the firm's needs evolve.
I mean, we're starting to bump up against time, but for the final part of our discussion, I wanted to, I think I'd be remiss not to do this. I wanted to get your expert opinion on the current state of the world economies and kind of your outlook as we look into next year. So starting with the U.S., clearly we have an economy that is grinding along here with slow growth. How do you think about the U.S. economy heading into next year?
One of the expressions that are used at the Fed is muddling through. That's when we want to describe a situation that is subject to ambiguities. And when you look at the Fed's own published predictions for growth, unemployment, and inflation, and the predictions of other students of the U.S. economy, I see us, the United States, as having no reason to panic and no reason to celebrate. We're just muddling through.
And the consensus is that the Fed will begin tapering process sometime in the early part of next year. Do you share this view? And what exactly, in your mind, does the taper look like? And will it create a shock to the world markets like we saw in July when the beginnings of the hint of the tapering beginning sent the currency markets into a tailspin?
What I'm about to say is going to sound a little commercial for the Fed. Here we go. Both Mr. Bernanke and Ms. Yellen have been unambiguous in their commitment to current policy so long as the economy is below full employment. So long as the unemployment rate remains above what the Federal Reserve deems consistent with full employment, I don't see any reason to be arguing about the tapering. Now, after stating the obvious, how would I implement this observation? Well, I would have a model for the federal funds rate determined by excess reserves of depository institutions along with the discount rate, the repo rate, and the interest rate on excess reserves. Other variables are clearly relevant. I would then monitor these variables and generate forecasts for the federal funds rate to see if I detect a tendency for this rate to increase. Remember, the federal funds rate is influenced, but not legally determined, by the Federal Reserve. In brief, I would just be monitoring these variables and using the little model that I have, or that I will be building, to shed some light on the road ahead. We want to see the curve in the road ahead of time.
Let's turn to Europe for a second. The ECB surprised the market with a 25 basis point rate cut last week, indicating, I guess from our perspective, that we have a persistently weak Eurozone economy. How do you see Europe playing out in 2014? And ultimately, do you see the euro surviving?
The answer to both questions is yes. I view the ECB's decision as an important one because the provision of liquidity at a low cost is bound to stimulate the economy. Having said that, now, let me say that one of the maxims of monetary policy in central banks is that monetary policy operates with long and variable lags. Milton Friedman is the one who crafted this view. The key word here is variable, which is a euphemism for saying we don't know when would it happen, but we have faith in that it will happen. So the answer to your question is I think the ECB decision is bound to stimulate the European economy. I think in addition, the ECB's decision is strengthening the incentives of Euro countries to remain in the Euro. Because if they were to entertain the alternative of ditching the Euro, then what interest rate would they be facing? They will not be facing the interest rate that currently prevails. So I think that the ECB's decision is strengthening the viability of the euro. And I think this is important for FSG clients because if the euro breaks down, that's going to create a fair amount of uncertainty.
The developed markets have a huge impact to some of the emerging markets. And given your views on the U.S. and Europe, how do you think about emerging markets and their economies for 2014? And we can start with the obvious BRIC economies, but then maybe highlight any others that you find of interest.
When thinking about the emerging market economies, I immediately think about China. And when I think about China, I immediately think about their acquisition of U.S. Treasury securities. And the question is, are they going to be doing this as they have been doing it from here on out? To argue that they will is reminiscent of mortgage lenders who argued that housing prices were going to rise forever because there was no evidence of prices declining. So I ask myself, well, what if China doesn't buy U.S. Treasuries? What would they buy? And if they don't buy U.S. Treasuries, what would be the effect on U.S. interest rate on currencies? And all of this brings us to the question of the role of monetary policy in advanced economies on capital flows in or out of EMEs. I do not have a persuasive answer to this question, but a recent speech by Governor Powell of the Federal Reserve Board is very helpful. He argues that the spillover of these monetary policies on growth prospects has two components. First, the volatility of capital flows into EMEs and the resulting appreciation has an adverse effect. On the other hand, these monetary policies keep advanced economies growing, which is the market for EMEs. Which effect is going to dominate? Well, the way the Fed answers this question is by using their model and simulating the effects of different monetary policies into EMEs. This is the way they address the uncertainty. They don't know which two effects is going to be the bigger one, and there's only one way that I know how to do it, and that is by simulating them and then comparing.
And ultimately, from that perspective, do the emerging markets win over the long haul?
My sense is yes, or at least the study from the Fed argues that yes, that it doesn't matter whether your currency is appreciating, depreciating, if the market in which you're going to try to sell does not exist. And so to the extent that monetary policies in advanced economies are keeping the markets of EME products growing, then to that extent, the EMEs will benefit over the long haul.
Okay. And I just have two final questions. The first is, what are some of the key big trends that you would advocate we watch across the world economies in 2014?
At the risk of being boring on this, I think that the action in the coming years is likely to be in international finance. And in particular, if the Fed begins the normalization of their balance sheet, this is a euphemism for tapering, one would expect an effect on the external value of the dollar. We also would expect an increase in the amount of interest paid by the U.S. government on its liabilities, which is a long way of saying a worsening of the U.S. budget deficit. And would also expect a change on the willingness of China to continue acquiring U.S. treasuries. So the first thing that I will be monitoring very closely is the Federal Reserve actions. I know that I'm stating the obvious, but I feel that not doing it involves a risk in missing the change. Again, I don't know the answer to these questions. I do know that the way it is done in some institutions, the Fed in particular, is to largely being avoided by surprises that affect you adversely. And the way I know how to do that is by you combine monitoring with the tool that you have to forecast and to generate scenarios analysis.
Okay, my last question, because I'm not going to let you out of this room without at least one bold prediction for next year, because we're at that time of the year where everybody likes to make predictions. So what is your bold prediction for next year?
When asked this question, my initial reaction was to invoke some really bold prediction, like the Redskins are going to win the Super Bowl. But then I feel like I'm just not saying anything particularly informative. So let me try to say something.
And your credibility would be severely
But if they win. But if they win, wow, that is some guy. Okay, so the idea is, what I want is to make the prediction, the following prediction. And it has to do with the history of the Fed. The Fed was founded in 1913, and it is currently celebrating its 100th anniversary. The prediction is that we're going to be wondering in 2 years from now, how come we didn't have a woman in charge of the Federal Reserve System?
Excellent. Jaime, thank you so much for the time and the insights. It was a pleasure spending this time with you as always, and I look forward to continuing the discussion and working closely with you in the coming year. I think we should try to do this on a quarterly basis because your perspectives are invaluable. As a reminder, you can access all of FSG's content on our portal at portal.frontierstrategygroup.com. This concludes our podcast. Until next time, we wish you great outperformance across your emerging market portfolio.